March 26, 1993, Dublin, Ireland. 26-year-old Annie McCarrick, an American-born citizen living in Ireland, leaves her apartment to travel to the Wicklow Mountains, but never returns. Even though Annie is allegedly seen that night with an unidentified man at a pub, no trace of her is ever found. Over the next 5 years, seven other women would go missing within the same 130-kilometre radius around Dublin. This leads to speculation that the cases might be connected, and the area becomes known as the Vanishing Triangle. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're traveling overseas to Ireland and profiling a number of different missing persons cases in order to explore a very interesting topic, the Vanishing Triangle. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Dara Mann, the winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, and she did a tremendous job, so thank you very much, Dara. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for the past 2 years, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions at the end of this episode. Anyways, you can probably tell by her accent, Dara hails from Ireland, and this was the story she requested I cover on the podcast when she originally entered the contest. During the intro, she mentioned the 1993 disappearance of Annie McCarrick, which generated a lot of publicity at the time, since Annie was an American citizen who had moved to Ireland only a few months before she went missing. But her case only turned out to be the tip of the iceberg, as over the course of the next 5 years, seven other young women would vanish without a trace in a specific area outside of Dublin, roughly within the boundaries of the province of Leinster. Once you mapped out the locations of all these disappearances, the area in which they took place resembled a triangle, which is how the Vanishing Triangle nickname came about. Anyway, this has caused speculation that a serial killer may have been responsible for murdering some or all of these missing women. Regardless of whether or not these 8 separate cases are connected, they all deserve to be explored on this episode. So I'm going to start off by discussing Annie McCarrick's case before I move on to the disappearances of the other 7 women. Afterward, I'll provide my theories and analysis of each of these cases, as well as discuss potential suspects. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start delving into the Vanishing Triangle. Our story begins in Ireland in 1993. Our first central figure is 26-year-old Annie McCarrick, who originally hails from the hamlet of Bayport in Long Island, New York. Annie is the only child of Nancy and John McCarrick, and her father happens to be a former police officer. At Christmas time in 1987, while attending Skidmore College, Annie took a trip to Ireland, where her maternal great-grandfather and great-grandmother originally hailed from. She became so enamored by the country that she decided to move there to continue her education, which involved taking teacher training courses at St. Patrick's Training College in the Drumcondra suburb of Dublin, as well as getting a degree in literature at St. Patrick's College in Maynooth. While Annie returned to the US for a couple of years to get a master's degree in English at Stony Brook University, she ultimately decided that she wanted to settle in Ireland and make it her permanent home. So in January of 1993, she returned to Dublin and moved into an apartment in the Sandymount suburb with two female roommates. She took a job as a waitress at a coffee shop called Cafe Java and was planning to take a higher diploma course which would help her fulfill her dream of becoming a teacher. On Friday, March the 26th, Annie's two roommates left on a weekend trip, so she started making her own plans. At around 11 a.m. that morning, Annie purchased some groceries at a local supermarket and was captured on CCTV visiting a bank. She was planning to visit Cafe Java later that day to pick up her paycheck and hoped to bake some desserts to deliver to her coworkers. Well, on the way back to her apartment, she stopped at a phone booth to call up a friend to ask if she would like to join her for a stroll through the Wicklow Mountains later that afternoon, but since her friend had recently injured her ankle, she declined. Annie would be seen leaving her apartment shortly after 3 p.m., and she subsequently got on the number 18 bus to the suburb of Ranelagh. At 3:40 p.m., a former co-worker of Annie saw her on the number 44 bus traveling from Ranelagh to Enniskerry, a village located 20 kilometers outside of Dublin in the foothills of the Wicklow Mountains. However, this would turn out to be the last confirmed sighting of Annie, and no one can even be certain if she got off the bus at Enniskerry. The evening of Saturday, March 27th, happened to be Annie's 27th birthday, and she was planning to host a dinner at her apartment with Hilary Brady, the brother of a former boyfriend of hers, and Hilary's fiancé. When they both arrived at Annie's apartment, they were surprised when no one answered the door. Since Hilary could not remember Annie's phone number, he went to a payphone and called Annie's parents in Long Island to get the number from them, but there was still no answer at the apartment. On Sunday, March the 28th, Annie's roommates returned from their weekend trip and discovered that Annie was not there. They were surprised to see that the shopping bag containing the groceries Annie had purchased on Friday was still resting on the counter, and none of the perishable items, such as cream and butter, had been placed in the fridge. It also turned out that Annie had left some laundry in the communal washing machine. After being unable to reach Annie, Hillary's fiancé decided to contact Cafe Java and was surprised to discover that Annie had not shown up for her scheduled shifts on Saturday and Sunday. In addition, she did not stop by there on Friday to pick up her paycheck or drop off desserts for coworkers like she had planned. This caused enough concern for Hillary to contact John and Nancy McCarrick to let them know Annie was missing, so they immediately got on a plane and traveled from New York to Dublin. Nancy had already been planning a trip there to visit her daughter on April the 2nd, and when she searched Annie's apartment, she discovered some theater tickets Annie had purchased for them to see a show together. Since Annie's passport was also left behind, it seemed very unlikely that she had taken off on her own. The McCarricks went to the Gardaí, the Irish police force, to officially report Annie missing, but by this point, she had not been seen for around 80 hours. Since she was last seen heading towards Enniskerry, an extensive search was performed of the surrounding area, which involved checking through hundreds of acres of woodland, but it failed to turn up any trace of her. However, there soon turned out to be an intriguing lead. When Annie's disappearance garnered coverage in the newspapers, a doorman who worked at a popular tourist spot named Johnny Fox's Pub, located in the village of Glencullen, came forward and claimed he recognized her photograph. On the evening of March 26th, the pub had been holding its nightly Hooli show, which involved traditional Irish music and folk dancing. The doorman claimed that sometime around 8 p.m., a woman matching Annie's description entered the pub, but seemed surprised when she was asked for a cover charge of £2. When she searched for some money, a clean-shaven man described as being in his mid-20s intervened and paid the cover charge for both of them. A second doorman would also remember seeing a woman matching Annie's description in the pub's back lounge that night, but it seemed that no one could actually recall seeing the woman leave the pub at any point. While a public plea was sent out for this unidentified man to come forward, no one ever did. The sighting was considered to be credible, since Annie had visited Johnny Fox's pub with her roommates on previous occasions. Glencullen was located 6 kilometers northwest from Enniskerry, so Annie theoretically could have walked there after she arrived on the number 44 bus, but there was some question about whether she would have done so, since it was a dark, cold, and wet night. After traveling to Ireland, John and Nancy McCarrick would remain there for the next 2 months to assist with the search efforts. They were not overly satisfied with the quality of the investigation, so they convinced a number of influential Americans, including Vice President Al Gore and U.S. Ambassador to Ireland Jean Kennedy Smith, to speak to the Irish President, Mary Robinson, and convince her to exert more pressure on the Gardaí. The McCarricks also hired a private investigator, and even managed to turn up a lead of their own while doing some legwork. While circulating Annie's photograph throughout Enniskerry, an employee at a local post office actually recognized her, claiming that she remembered selling stamps to a young woman with an American accent sometime between 4 and 5 p.m. on March the 26th. She turned out to be the only witness who could place Annie in Enniskerry on that particular day, but it's never been conclusively confirmed if the woman the employee saw was Annie. Even after John McCarrick offered a $150,000 reward for information, the investigation remained at a standstill. Sadly, the ordeal of Annie's disappearance eventually caused the McCarricks to divorce. While Nancy continues to make appearances in the media to keep her daughter's case in the spotlight, John passed away in 2009. I'll be exploring Annie's disappearance in more detail in a little while, but now I'm going to discuss how her case would end up being linked to the disappearances of several other women. In 1998, the Gardaí announced that they were putting together a new task force called Operation Trace, which would specifically investigate the unsolved disappearances of 6 young women and explore the possibility that they might be connected. These disappearances had all occurred within the past 5 years, within the same 130-kilometer radius outside of Dublin, an area which would come to be known as the Vanishing Triangle. As time went on, 2 other unsolved disappearances which took place within the Triangle during this time period were added to the list, making 8 missing women in total. Annie McCarrick was the first of these victims to vanish, and I'm now going to give a quick synopsis of the next 7 cases in chronological order. These first 2 cases were the aforementioned disappearances which did not get added to the Vanishing Triangle list until later on. On July 25, 1993, 39-year-old Eva Brennan was visiting her parents' home for a Sunday afternoon family lunch, and after getting into a minor argument with her siblings, she left to return to her apartment in the Tyrannier suburb of Dublin. It was common practice for Eva to visit her parents virtually every day for lunch, but when they did not hear from her for 2 days, Eva's father decided to visit her apartment. He discovered that she was not there, but while her purse and keys were missing, the rain jacket Eva had worn to the Sunday lunch was inside the apartment, indicating that she had returned there at some point. Eva suffered from depression and was known for not going out very much, but no trace of her was ever found. Our next disappearance took place on January the 3rd, 1994, in the city of Waterford. 22-year-old Imelda Keenan was living in an apartment with her fiancé and told him she was heading to the post office when she left at 1:30 p.m. An acquaintance of Imelda's would see her cross the road at the corner of the Tower Hotel and Lombard Street, but after that, she was never heard from again. On November 9, 1995, 21-year-old Josephine Dullard, who went by the nickname Jojo, was planning to make a 145-kilometer trip from Dublin to her hometown of Callan, but missed the last scheduled bus of the evening and decided to hitchhike her way home. She caught rides with at least 2 separate motorists, the last of whom dropped her off in the village of Moon. At 11:37 p.m., Jojo went to a phone booth and called her flatmate in Callan, which was still over 70 kilometers away. She told her friend she was having trouble thumbing another ride, but then mentioned that a car was coming and ended the call. Eyewitnesses would later report seeing a woman matching Jojo's description approximately 50 yards away from the phone booth, leaning into the back door of a dark vehicle which resembled a Toyota Carina, but this car and its driver have never been identified, and Jojo was never seen again. There would be 1 more odd sighting during the early morning hours of November the 10th, from a taxi driver who was driving through the village of Kilmacow, located about an hour south of Moon. He claimed he saw a man urinating outside a red parked car by the side of the road when a barefoot, distressed-looking woman exited the vehicle. It looked like she was attempting to run away, but a second man emerged from the car and dragged her back inside before they drove away. However, it was never conclusively determined if this woman was JoJo. The next disappearance occurred in 1996 and involved 25-year-old Fiona Pender, who was 7 months pregnant and living in the town of Tullamore with her boyfriend, John Thompson. Fiona's mother last saw her when she dropped her daughter off at her apartment at around 7 p.m. on August the 22nd. John claimed he woke up at 6 a.m. the following morning in order to go work at his family's farm, and that Fiona was still in bed when he left. John spent the night at the farm, but received a call the following evening from Fiona's mother, who said Fiona was not at her apartment and could not be found anywhere, so she was subsequently reported missing. In 1997, 17-year-old Ciara Breen was living with her single mother, Bernadette Breen, in the town of Dundalk. They both went to bed shortly after midnight on February the 13th, but when Bernadette woke up at around 2 a.m. to use the bathroom, she was surprised to discover that her daughter was not there. Sierra's bedroom window was unlatched, which seemed to indicate that she had snuck out and was planning to return later that morning, but she never did and has not been seen since. On the evening of February the 8th, 1998, 19-year-old Fiona Sinnott and three of her friends went out to a local pub in the village of Broadway. Fiona had an 11-month-old daughter named Emma, but had broken up with the child's 28-year-old father, Sean Carroll, months earlier. They were currently sharing custody of Emma, who was spending this particular night with Sean's parents. Sean also happened to be at the pub at the same time as Fiona, though they did not hang out together. When midnight hit, Fiona left to walk back to her house, but since she had spent the evening complaining about pains in her arm and upper body, Sean offered to accompany her home. Sean would later claim that he spent the night at Fiona's house sleeping on the couch, but after he woke up and walked into her bedroom, Fiona was still complaining about feeling unwell because of the pain in her body. Sean then said he gave Fiona some money to go see a doctor before his mother arrived to pick him up. Well, Fiona was never seen again, and there would be no record of her having seen a doctor that day. After not hearing from her for 9 days, Fiona's family finally reported her missing. The final Vanishing Triangle disappearance would take place on July the 28th, 1998, when 18-year-old Deirdre Jacob visited the town of Newbridge. Deirdre stopped by a bank and a post office, and also visited her grandmother at a sweet shop she owned, before she left to make the 25-minute walk back to her family's home, located on the outskirts of town on Barrettstown Road. She was seen by multiple eyewitnesses, and the last sighting took place at around 3 p.m., when Deirdre was only 200 yards away from the gateway to her house. But something seemed to happen to Deirdre before she arrived, and she inexplicably vanished without a trace. At the time, Deirdre was carrying a black canvas bag with the word cat written on it in distinct yellow letters, but this item was also never found. Deirdre's disappearance was what prompted the Gardaí to launch Operation Trace and investigate the possibility that all 8 of the aforementioned cases might be connected and that each of these missing women might have been the victim of a serial killer. But after 2 decades, no conclusive evidence has ever been found to link these disappearances, so all these cases are still unsolved, and none of the 8 missing women from Ireland's Vanishing Triangle have ever been found. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. I can honestly say that this is the first podcast episode in which I've discussed 8 separate missing persons cases, and it's been quite a challenge to convey this information in a manner which wasn't confusing. If you're already familiar with any of these cases, you probably noticed that there are a lot of key details about many of these stories which I haven't revealed yet, but rest assured, they're coming momentarily. I honestly really didn't know all that much about the Vanishing Triangle before I started researching this episode, but after looking at this situation as a whole, I personally believe that there's no way that all 8 of these crimes were committed by the same person. Truthfully, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if none of these cases were connected at all. Don't get me wrong, I'm more than happy to explore all of these disappearances because they're all still unsolved and deserve all the attention and exposure they can get. Back in 1988, when the whole vanishing triangle theory was developed, it might have seemed more plausible that these cases were linked, since they all took place within the previous 5 years in a relatively small geographic region. But over the past 2 decades, more information has come out about the disappearances, and it seems pretty obvious that at least some of these crimes were personal in nature, and the victim was murdered by someone they knew, not some random serial killer. Specifically, in the disappearances of Fiona Pender, Ciara Breen, and Fiona Sinnott, it sounds like authorities are pretty certain they know who did it, but they've just lacked sufficient evidence to file charges. So I'm going to talk about these 3 cases first. I should preface this by making reference to Section 4 of Ireland's Criminal Justice Act, which allows the Gardaí to bring in suspects and detain them for up to 24 hours without charging them, though it was 12 hours prior to 2006. Section 4 was utilized in all 3 of these cases, but of course no one was ever charged. Let's start with Fiona Pender. As you recall, her boyfriend, John Thompson, claimed that he last saw Fiona when he left their apartment at 6 a.m. on the morning of August 23rd to go work on his family farm, and he did not learn she was missing until Fiona's mother phoned him there the following evening. Well, in 1997, John, his 3 sisters, and their father were all detained by the Gardaí under Section 4 to be questioned about Fiona's disappearance, though nothing ever came of it. On the evening of August 22nd, an eyewitness remembered seeing 2 men carrying what appeared to be a rolled-up carpet outside Fiona's apartment building before placing it in the back of a 4x4 vehicle. Later that night, another witness saw a 4x4 being driven on a remote road in the Slieve Lun Mountains. In 2008, a wooden cross bearing Fiona Pender's name suddenly appeared on a trail in those same mountains. This led to speculation her remains might be buried somewhere in the area, but a search turned up nothing. The prominent theory in this case is that John Thompson killed Fiona and enlisted his family's assistance to cover the whole thing up, which would make sense since John's alibi was that he was at his family farm during the time period Fiona allegedly went missing. The case took a surprising turn when the prime suspect in Fiona's disappearance was arrested in Canada in 2014. Due to a publication ban, this man could not be identified, though you could probably infer who it was. By this point, the suspect was living in Saskatchewan with his family before he was charged with sexually assaulting and threatening to kill his wife. When the Royal Canadian Mounted Police searched his home, they found a number of videos of this man engaged in sexual activity with his wife, but she claimed these incidents occurred while she was unconscious, as she often woke up in her bed with no memory of the events. During the man's trial, his wife testified that he had once told her, quote, "You know I've done it before, they'll never find you, you'll end up like her," end quote. She suspected that the reason he wanted to move to Canada was because they had no extradition agreement with Ireland. Well, the Chief Justice at the trial did not believe there was sufficient evidence to prove the allegations against the defendant, so he was found not guilty on all charges. These events failed to generate any leads in Fiona Pender's disappearance, and the suspect's current whereabouts are unknown. But yes, I definitely believe that John Thompson was the suspect and is the most likely perpetrator here, and that Fiona's case has no connection with any of the others. Now, the evidence against Sean Carroll, the prime suspect in Fiona Sinnott's disappearance, seems even more damning. Even though they had broken up months earlier and were sharing custody of their infant daughter, Sean claimed that he walked Fiona home from the pub, spent the night at her house, and gave her money to go to the doctor the following morning. But there was no record of Fiona ever having seen a doctor, and no independent eyewitness sightings of her after she was seen leaving the pub with Sean. It would be 9 days before Fiona was officially reported missing, and when the Gardaí searched the residence, they were surprised by how barren it was. It looked like the house had been cleared out, as there were very few personal belongings to indicate that a young woman and her child had once lived there. Witnesses would later recall having seen some black refuse bags on the property during the time period Fiona went missing, and a farmer came forward claiming to have found refuse bags in one of his fields containing some documentation with Fiona Sinnott's name on it. Unfortunately, the farmer did not yet know that Fiona was a missing person and just assumed the bags had been illegally dumped, so he burned all the evidence. Investigators would come to believe that multiple people were involved in covering up Fiona's disappearance, including one man who was suspected of helping dispose of her body and seemed to be suffering enormous guilt over it. When the guardie implied that he could send in an anonymous tip, this man said that only the killer and one other person knew the location of Fiona's body, so it would pretty much be a death sentence if he talked. He subsequently died of a drug overdose in 2001. In 2005, three men and three women, who were not identified, were detained for 12 hours under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act to be questioned about the disappearance, but much like Fiona Pender's case, they were all released without being charged. It's also been reported that Fiona was in a violent relationship with an older ex-boyfriend in which she was severely beaten and wound up in the hospital multiple times. The only time Fiona ever reported one of these incidents to the authorities is when this boyfriend threatened her with a knife. But when the guardie showed up at her house, she said she didn't want to make a formal complaint. None of the sources I've ever seen have ever specifically stated that Sean Carroll and this violent ex-boyfriend were the same person, but I think there are enough hints to suggest that they are. I believe that something went horribly wrong after Fiona and Sean left the pub together that night, as Sean probably did not react well to their breakup and being forced to share custody of their daughter. Much like John Thompson, Sean spent the next few days enlisting assistance from others to cover up the crime. I seriously doubt that some random serial killer is going to go to the trouble of removing most of Fiona's personal belongings from her house. Unfortunately, by the time the guardie became involved, there was little evidence to work with. Now, Ciara Breen's disappearance might be the most heartbreaking of all these stories. When her mother Bernadette discovered that she was missing from their home and that her bedroom window was unlatched, Bernadette figured she had snuck out and would return eventually. Well, it turned out the reason Ciara likely did this was to secretly meet a 34-year-old man named Liam Mullen. He had been seen hanging around Ciara and her friends at a local chip shop and was allegedly infatuated with her. On two separate occasions, in 1999 and 2015, the guardie received information from witnesses to compel them to detain Mullen under Section 4, as he apparently made a number of drunken confessions to Ciara's murder over the years, but would always recant whenever he sobered up. But like the other two aforementioned cases, Mullen was released without being charged. In 2017, Mullen was arrested for drunk driving, and while in police custody, he managed to swallow a bag of heroin and succumb to an overdose. This news absolutely devastated Bernadette, as she believed that Mullen was the only person who knew the location of her daughter, and Bernadette herself would pass away the following year. The guardie suspect that Sierra's remains might be in a marshland area called Bomber's Bog, but searches have turned up nothing. Once again, I think it's pretty obvious that something bad happened to Ciara after she left her house to have this secret late-night meeting with Mullen, but since he is currently deceased, recovering her remains might be a daunting task. Much like with Fiona Pender and Fiona Sinnott, Ciara's story seems like another tragic case of a young woman falling prey to a man she knew, but without the victim's body, investigators were unable to make an arrest and close the case for good. While I do hope these three victims can be found someday, I am pretty confident that none of them have any connection to the other Vanishing Triangle cases. So now let's talk about the disappearances of Eva Brennan and Imelda Keenan. Like I mentioned earlier, the Vanishing Triangle initially consisted of only six cases, but these two were added to the list later on. But unfortunately, there is just so little information out there about these cases that there's nothing to conclusively prove or disprove that they're connected to the others. The Eva Brennan disappearance sticks out because at 39 years old, she was quite a bit older than the other victims. But Eva was described as looking young for her age, and looking at her photograph, I tend to agree, so she could have been targeted by someone who thought she was younger than she really was. Eva's family have always been outspoken about their belief that the Gardaí mishandled her case and that she was overshadowed by the disappearance of Annie McCarrick, who went missing only 4 months earlier and garnered the majority of the attention. Since Eva suffered from depression, her family suspected that the Gardaí took the attitude that she went off somewhere to commit suicide. I mean, I guess that's certainly possible, but the problem is that there is just so little evidence in this case pointing to either suicide or foul play. The only thing we know for certain is that the jacket Eva wore when she visited her family for lunch was found inside her apartment, so she did make it back there at some point, but since her purse and keys were missing, this suggests that she left again at a later time. But it's anyone's guess what happened to her. Imelda Keenan's disappearance is equally as frustrating, because she also seemed to vanish into thin air, and there isn't much to work with. I know that Imelda was living with her fiancé at the time, who claimed she left their apartment to head to the post office, but unlike the Fiona Pender and Fiona Sinnott cases, it doesn't look like he was ever considered a suspect. His story was supported by the fact that an eyewitness who knew Imelda personally saw her crossing the street that afternoon, but after that, there's nothing to go on. It's certainly possible that Eva or Imelda were abducted and murdered by a predator that was also responsible for the disappearances of some of the other victims, but without any evidence, this is nothing more than pure speculation. So the disappearances which could possibly have some connections between them are Annie McCarrick, JoJo Dullard, and Deirdre Jacob. But before we go any deeper into these cases, we have to talk about some people who have been named as possible suspects. One of them is Robert Lessarian Howard, who gained notoriety after receiving a life sentence for the 2001 rape and murder of 14-year-old schoolgirl Hannah Williams. Prior to this, Howard was a convicted sex offender who had been in and out of prison multiple times for numerous sex crimes dating back nearly 40 years. Even though the Hannah Williams murder took place in London, Howard had lived in Ireland during the time period when a number of the Vanishing Triangle disappearances took place. He even went on trial for the 1994 disappearance of 15-year-old Arlene Arkinson, who vanished from the village of Castledurg, though her body was never found, and Howard was ultimately acquitted of the crime. At the very least, Howard has been looked at as a possible suspect in the disappearances of Annie McCarrick and JoJo Dullard, but no specific connections have been made, and Howard died of cancer in prison in 2015. Another potential suspect is a former Army sergeant named John Creer, who is currently serving a life sentence for the 1979 abduction, rape, and murder of 23-year-old Phyllis Murphy, whose remains were found in the Wicklow Mountains. The crime took place in Newbridge, and Creer would be linked to it via DNA testing 2 decades later. There is a small connection between Creer and the disappearance of JoJo Dullard. The night after JoJo went missing, a local resident claimed that she saw Creer's vehicle outside a disused quarry located about 20 kilometers away from the village of Moon, which is where JoJo was last seen. The gates were opened and the lights were on, and Creer was often seen digging and burning stuff inside this quarry on multiple occasions. On this particular night, the witness claimed she saw Creer arguing with a younger man. Much like with Robert Lessarian Howard, there really isn't anything concrete to link Creer with any of these disappearances, but the aforementioned witness thought the man she saw with Creer bore a resemblance to the next person we're going to talk about, who many people believe is the most promising suspect, Larry Murphy. On February the 11th, 2000, a young woman was abducted from a car park in the town of Carlow by 35-year-old Larry Murphy, who tied the victim's hands with her own bra and locked her in the trunk of his car. After driving the woman to a remote location to rape her, Murphy then proceeded to drive her to another remote spot, this time in the Wicklow Mountains. After raping the victim multiple times, Murphy attempted to put her back into the trunk, but when she started fighting back, he placed a plastic bag over her head to suffocate her. But remarkably, a pair of hunters just happened to drive past the scene at this moment, prompting Murphy to flee. The woman was left behind and wound up surviving her ordeal, and one of the hunters actually recognized Murphy, as he only lived 3 kilometers away from the location with his wife and children. Murphy was subsequently arrested at his home and identified as the attacker by the victim. After pleading guilty to rape and attempted murder, Murphy received a 15-year prison sentence, but after only serving 10 of those years, he was released from prison in August of 2010. Well, needless to say, there was a major backlash over this, as Murphy reportedly showed no remorse whatsoever for his crime and refused all the sex offender rehabilitation programs available to him in prison. He would spend the next few years moving around between different countries like Spain, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom, and as of 2014, he was reported to be living in South London under an assumed name. Given the brutal nature of his attack on the young woman, a lot of people were inclined to believe that this was not Murphy's first crime. In fact, when Murphy was questioned about the attack, he stated, quote, "She was lucky," as if to imply he had done something like this before. Since all the Vanishing Triangle disappearances took place before Murphy went to prison, attempts were made to find potential links between him and the cases. Of course, Murphy's attempted murder took place in the Wicklow Mountains, which is where Annie McCarrick was traveling to when she disappeared, though the mountains span over 500 kilometers in total, and the attack occurred about an hour away from where Annie went missing. But Murphy did seem to match the description of the unidentified man seen with the woman resembling Annie at Johnny Fox's pub. But the most compelling connection was made between Murphy and Deirdre Jacobs' disappearance. You might recall how Deirdre was visiting her grandmother's sweet shop in Newbridge shortly before she disappeared. After the grandmother passed away, a piece of paper containing Larry Murphy's name and phone number was found in her possessions. It also turned out that he had visited Newbridge in the weeks prior to Deirdre's disappearance to look into a carpentry job at a local pub, and while he did return to the town 2 months later to do the job, he could not actually be placed in Newbridge on the day Deirdre went missing. A prisoner who served time with Murphy also claimed that he had once bragged about having abducted a woman outside of Newbridge. Murphy has been extensively questioned by the Gardaí about his possible role in the Vanishing Triangle disappearances, but he has denied involvement in all of them, and no evidence has ever implicated him. Well, the families of Jojo Dullard and Deirdre Jacob have openly expressed their skepticism that Murphy was responsible for what happened to them. Shortly after Jojo went missing, her family received a confession letter from a woman claiming to be the ex-girlfriend of a man whom she believed was responsible for murdering Jojo. Jojo's sister said that she brought the letter to the local Gardaí station, but investigators never acted on the tip, and since the family never made a photocopy of the letter, they haven't seen it since. They claim that the man named in the letter is related to a politician who has used their influence to protect the killer. The Dullard family seemed to think that the confession letter is so credible that they flat out stated their belief that Larry Murphy did not murder Jojo. Well, without knowing any more specific details about this letter, I have no idea how credible these allegations are. Of course, it's pretty obvious that Jojo was abducted shortly after finishing her phone call with her friend, as she mentioned that a car was coming before she hung up, and witnesses believe they saw her standing next to a dark-colored vehicle resembling a Toyota Carina. Of course, we had that weird sighting from the taxi driver a few hours later of two men grabbing a woman who appeared to be running away and dragging her back into their vehicle, but it's not even clear if that was Jojo. And this vehicle was described as being a red car, not a dark-colored Carina, and the sighting took place about 90 kilometers south from where Jojo was last seen. But since Jojo had already hitchhiked with multiple motorists prior to her disappearance, it's possible she could have climbed into the Carina in Moon and was only driven part of the way home before she hitched a ride in the red car at a later time. It's interesting that two men were in that red vehicle, and we have a witness who believes she saw John Creer and a man who resembled Larry Murphy arguing outside a quarry the following night. But other than that, there's zero evidence that Creer and Murphy even knew each other, let alone teamed up to commit a murder, so the link between those two men and this case is very weak. Now we'll move on to Deirdre Jacobs' disappearance, which is particularly terrifying, as it seems she somehow got abducted only yards away from her home in a very narrow window of time, but no one saw anything. However, Deirdre's family have stated that the link between Larry Murphy and their daughter's case is not as strong as it's made out to be. Many sources have reported that the reason Murphy's name and phone number were found among the possessions of Deirdre's grandmother is because he did carpentry work at her shop, and she wrote this information down on a check stub. But the Jacob family insist that's not true. They claim that Murphy had handcrafted some wooden toys and visited a lot of shops in Newbridge in an attempt to sell them. When he saw Deirdre's grandmother, she took down his name and number, but they believe this took place years before Deirdre even went missing and has no significance to the case. While they don't completely discount the possibility that Murphy could have been responsible for Deirdre's disappearance, the Jacobs just don't want all the focus to be placed on him and other potential leads to be overlooked. So the last case we're going to talk about is Annie McCarrick, which I believe is probably the oddest of all these disappearances. But first, we need to take a brief moment to talk about two unsolved murders which took place before the Vanishing Triangle disappearances and are sometimes linked to these cases. On July the 11th, 1987, Antoinette Smith, a 27-year-old mother of two, traveled from Dublin to Slane Castle to attend a David Bowie concert. After she returned to Dublin, she was last seen leaving a nightclub at around 2:30 a.m. on July the 12th, before she went missing. 9 months later, her remains were discovered in a shallow grave in the foothills of the Wicklow Mountains. She had a plastic bag tied around her head, much like the victim in the Larry Murphy case. On December the 23rd, 1991, 34-year-old Patricia Doherty went missing while Christmas shopping in the Dublin suburb of Tallaght before her remains were found buried in the Wicklow Mountains the following June, only a few kilometers away from the location where Antoinette Smith was discovered. Like I mentioned earlier, the Wicklow Mountains span over 500 kilometers, but it's certainly possible that the same perpetrator might have been responsible for both these murders and was also involved in Annie McCarrick's disappearance. And the presence of a plastic bag over Antoinette Smith's head provides a compelling possible connection to Larry Murphy. But let's go back to the beginning of Annie's case and retrace her movements. We know that she was seen on a bus heading to Enniskerry, which is located in the foothills of the Wicklow Mountains, but no one can say with 100% certainty if she arrived. The only reported sightings of her in the area were from an employee at an Enniskerry post office who believed she sold stamps to Annie, and the doorman who saw her at Johnny Fox's pub in Glencullen. Of course, as I've stated countless times before on this podcast, eyewitnesses in missing persons cases can be mistaken all the time, but one reason these sightings of Annie might be credible is that she was an American living in Ireland. How many other young women with an American accent matching Annie's description would these witnesses have spoken to that night? Well, interestingly enough, investigators did discover that there was another American woman in Johnny Fox's pub on the evening of March 26th, but it turned out she was there with her mother. The woman believed to be Annie was with an unidentified man who paid her cover charge, so it seems unlikely that the doorman could have mixed these two women up. And of course, if the woman was not Annie, and the man she was with had no involvement in her disappearance, why did they never come forward after this case garnered substantial publicity? We know that Annie had been to Johnny Fox's on prior occasions and seemed to love the place, so it's not implausible that she could have been there. There's just some question about whether she would have made a 6-kilometer walk from Enniskerry to Glencullen on such a cold, wet night. One of the most curious details about this case is that Annie did not unpack the groceries she purchased that morning, even though some of the items needed to be refrigerated, and she also left some laundry in the communal washing machine. Annie also did not stop off at Café Java to pick up her paycheck like she planned, and even though there was a nearly 4-hour window between when Annie bought the groceries and when she left her apartment, she never bothered to start baking the desserts she was going to bring to her co-workers. This suggests that Annie wasn't planning to be gone that long, so it is curious that she would decide to take an extra detour to the pub, especially since it would be more difficult to secure transportation back to Dublin after it got late. Well, in recent years, a new theory has emerged about Annie's disappearance. In 2014, a retired detective sergeant named Alan Bailey, who had once served as the national coordinator for the Operation Trace Task Force, published a book titled Missing Presumed, which explored the Vanishing Triangle disappearances and devoted an entire chapter to Annie's case. According to Bailey, the Gardaí had received information from a quote-unquote very reliable source that the man seen with Annie at Johnny Fox's pub was a member of the West Belfast Brigade of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, aka the IRA. While the Gardaí knew the identity of this man, Bailey referred to him in the book under a pseudonym, Manus Dunn. The source apparently claimed that Dunn was a quote-unquote hitman, and that after paying Annie's cover charge, he spent the evening conversing with her at the pub and started bragging about his exploits in the IRA. However, once Dunn began naming names and sharing specific details, he realized that he had revealed too much information to Annie and would have to get rid of her. He offered Annie a lift to a taxi rank so she could catch a ride back to Dublin, then made the calculated decision to ask Annie to meet him in the car park while he went to use the bathroom. That way, no one would see them leaving the pub together. After meeting Annie in the car park, Dunn drove her into the Wicklow Mountains and pulled into an isolated lay-by where he proceeded to strangle Annie to death. He then concealed her body in some bushes before driving to the Rathfarnham suburb of Dublin, where he was staying at a safe house with some IRA colleagues. Dunn told his colleagues that he had killed Annie because she was a special branch undercover agent who was attempting to obtain information from him, so the following morning, they assisted Dunn with moving her body and burying it at a more secluded location in the mountains. Anyway, the story goes that months later, Dunn was accused of raping the 12-year-old daughter of another IRA member. An internal court-martial was held, but since both of these men were considered prominent members of the organization, there was fear of a potential rift if Dunn was punished, so a decision was made to exile him. He was sent to the United States, where he was set up with a new job and a new identity, and was told never to return to Ireland under punishment of death. The Gardaí did make an attempt to track this man down for questioning, but since so many years had passed, they were unable to locate him. Well, needless to say, the idea of Annie being murdered by a hitman from the IRA and the organization covering the whole thing up sounds like a larger-than-life scenario that you would find in a movie. But Alan Bailey maintained that the source who provided this information was a very credible one, so investigators did take the lead seriously. Even if the story is true, it sounds like the detail about this guy killing Annie because he blabbed too much about his IRA activities is third or fourth-hand information. Since the guy was allegedly a predator who raped a 12-year-old girl, this may have been the same reason he decided to murder Annie, but he fabricated certain details in order to convince his IRA colleagues to help him cover the whole thing up. Since no one seems to know the current whereabouts of the man known as Manus Dunn, it's really difficult to determine the veracity of this whole story, though I'd be inclined to think that the truth is a lot more simple, and that Annie simply crossed paths with a random predator that night who did her harm. For all we know, it could have been Larry Murphy, as he apparently did have a resemblance to the man seen in Johnny Fox's pub. But it's also possible that Annie ran into her killer shortly after she arrived in Enniskerry and never even made it to the pub. The problem is that there's really nothing to conclusively link Murphy to Annie's disappearance or any of the Vanishing Triangle cases for that matter. Murphy is pretty much a unique enigma in that he's officially only been connected to one crime, but that crime was so heinous that many people believe that he must have harmed others. He was certainly capable of murder, as the only reason his victim survived was because of the incredible good fortune of those hunters driving by the scene at that exact moment. Murphy definitely deserved a harsher prison sentence than 15 years, and as far as I'm concerned, the crime of attempted murder should be given the same weight as murder, since it was only dumb luck which prevented him from taking someone's life. It's probably not an exaggeration to say that Murphy may have been the most despised person in Ireland at the time he was released from prison, and the idea that he's currently free and capable of harming more people is frightening. I know that the family members of some of the other Vanishing Triangle victims have expressed their belief that Murphy was not the perpetrator, but if I was them, and I read the horrific details of Murphy's attack on the woman he did abduct, I'd probably be hoping the same thing. So the Vanishing Triangle is definitely a convoluted rabbit hole, but let's look at the big picture. There's ample evidence pointing to a specific suspect in the disappearances of Fiona Pender, Fiona Sinnott, and Ciara Breen, as each of these women were likely murdered by a man from their personal lives. But when it comes to the disappearances of Annie McCarrick, Eva Brennan, Imelda Keenan, JoJo Dullard, and Deirdre Jacob, as well as the murders of Antoinette Smith and Patricia Doherty, there's very little evidence pointing to anyone in particular, and nothing that definitively proves that these cases are connected. The only thing I'm certain about in this story is that while the concept of Ireland's Vanishing Triangle is a spooky hook, which has helped bring attention to each of these cases, there's really nothing to suggest that all these women were the victim of a serial killer, and it's probably nothing more than a coincidence that they all happened to go missing within the same triangular 130-kilometer radius. If there is a serial killer involved in this story, I'd say that they were probably responsible for maybe two or three of these disappearances at the most. But don't get me wrong, even though I might sound pretty cynical about the whole vanishing triangle concept, I'm not going to complain about it, because it's given additional exposure to a number of missing persons cases which are still unsolved. Here in North America, I can tell you that a number of true crime buffs have heard of the Vanishing Triangle, but they probably would never have heard of most of these individual cases were they not grouped together like this. In each of these disappearances, the victims' families have been left completely devastated by what happened, and worked tirelessly to keep their stories in the spotlight. I do think that some of these cases are solvable, since investigators have a pretty good idea who did it, but just lack the evidence to make an arrest. But some of the other cases are complete puzzlers, and literally seem like the victim just vanished into thin air. So if you happen to have any information about any of the cases discussed on this episode, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Dara Mann for narrating our opening. We've been doing this contest for 2 years now, and if you've already entered it in the past, you are still automatically eligible for all our random monthly drawings, so you don't have to do anything else. But if you would like to enter the contest, and haven't already done so, please send me an email with the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, listing the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and we've got another one lined up this month. And our patrons in tier 3 also have access to some audio commentary tracks I've recorded, which can be played over classic episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listener who has signed up with us on Patreon this week, Vanessa S. Thank you so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.